Good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at offbeatoregon.com, and this is the daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. It's Monday, so this is an archive show, first published as a newspaper column sometime in the last 15 years. Thanks for downloading, and I hope you enjoy the show. This story was first published on January 22nd of 2017 under the headline Quest for the Blue Bucket Mine Led Suckers to Actual Riches. It's a rewriting and thorough re-researching of a much shorter column first published back in April of 2009. Here we go. Oregon, like many other states, has an official state bird, the western meadowlark. Animal, the beaver, of course. Tree, the Douglas fir. And gemstone, the sunstone. And so on and so forth. Down to the ubiquitous state beverage, milk, just like nearly every other state with a dairy industry. But if the state were going to designate an official state legend, it could do a whole lot worse than to designate the story of the Lost Blue Bucket Mine. The Lost Blue Bucket Mine is a story from the early days of the Oregon Trail. It's probably completely untrue. But then again, maybe it's not. And its very existence as a myth changed Oregon history in several important ways. Here's the legend. Back in 1845, a big party of emigrants was moving west along the Oregon Trail when members started hearing rumors about Native Americans planning to attack in the Blue Mountains. While they were wondering what to do about this, mountain man Stephen Meek told them he could lead them to a cutoff route over land and around the Blue Mountains into safety. Some 200 wagons worth of people took him up on it, and they branched off from the Oregon Trail at Vail and headed out into the Oregon High Desert. The venture was a disaster. The going was very difficult, and it soon became clear that Meek, although he had been through eastern Oregon a time or two, hadn't taken very good notes. When he arrived at the Alkali Lake country, the changes in drought conditions had rendered the whole landscape unfamiliar to him. Conditions went from stressed to desperate, and then people started dying. Finally, the party split up, with one group going north and the other continuing west. Eventually, both parties found the Deschutes River and followed it north to the Columbia, where they rejoined the regular trail. Both parties by this time were exhausted, out of supplies or nearly so, and noticeably depleted in numbers. At least 23 of them died, probably more, and many more arrived in the dalles in such weakened condition that they didn't survive the subsequent winter. By that time, Meek himself was nowhere to be found. Meek, after hearing a credible report that a grieving father who had lost two children to the hardships of the trail was now coming after him with murder in mind, slipped away from the wagon train in the dark of night. But along the trail, just after the party split into two groups, members of one of the two groups apparently found the Blue Bucket Mine. According to the legend, shortly after the party split, one of the two groups was camping for the night near the edge of a river or big creek, possibly the John Day River. A group of the children from the party went down to the river, probably to fetch water, and when they came back up, they brought with them an assortment of strangely heavy yellow pebbles in the bottom of their blue graniteware bucket. The riverbed was full of the things, so many that you could remove them with a shovel. The adults in the party found these pebbles very interesting. One of them whacked one with a hammer on a wagon tire and it mashed flat like a lump of lead. Another figured out that these funny rocks made great fishing sinkers, and with their help they were able to get plenty to eat that night for the first time in a long time. Then it came time to break camp, and the kids wanted to bring the funny yellow rocks with them as souvenirs. Nothing doing, said the grown-ups. The oxen were already starving and barely pulling their own weight. The whole wagon train was in imminent danger of exhaustion. There was no room for extra toys. And so back into the river went the strange yellow pebbles, and on pressed the hard-pressed party, to the dalles and eventually to the Willamette Valley, where they thought little more about the strange heavy yellow pebbles in the blue water bucket until 3 years later, in 1848, when the California Gold Rush got started. And only then did they realize that they had camped next to a vast fortune in gold nuggets. If only they knew where that campsite was, they could go back and... Now, the red flags on this legend are legion. First of all, the idea that nobody in the party would have recognized the nuggets as gold even after one had been mashed on a wagon tire is highly suspect. Remember, this was an age when people sometimes had to bite gold coins to verify they were real. Secondly, even if they had failed to recognize the pebbles as gold, wouldn't someone have brought some of them along as fishing tackle? Granted, they had lead for bullets and could have made sinkers out of that, but bullets had their own uses on the trail. Speaking of which, it is kind of silly, isn't it, to think that the party was desperate for fishing sinkers when they were presumably carrying bullets? And why are there no names associated with this story? Sure, the people involved could have tried to keep quiet about it, hoping to go back and cash in, but there were 2 or 3 years in which they supposedly had no idea what they had found, and their unusually difficult Oregon Trail experience would have been a frequent topic of conversation with their new neighbors during that time. How is it that we don't know who they were? How likely is it that those kids also wouldn't have slipped a pebble or two into a pocket? So, there's pretty good reason to believe this story is, if not outright falsehood, at least greatly and imaginatively augmented. But regardless of its truthiness, it had a dramatic impact on the state's history. In 1861, a dozen years or so after the California Gold Rush broke out, a man named J.L. Adams showed up in Portland, bragging that he had found the Lost Blue Bucket Mine and claiming that he was recruiting a party to help him work it. Most Portlanders didn't need to be asked twice. Everyone had heard the legend. In a jiffy, Adams had 58 men ready to go, and off they went. The problem was it quickly became obvious that he wasn't leading them anywhere in particular. He'd stop at promising-looking creeks to shake some gravel around in his pan, and if he found a little, he'd poke around there for a day or two. In other words, he was acting like a man prospecting for a gold deposit, not a man who'd found a huge one and was on his way back to work it. Finally, some other members of the party, grown suspicious, collared him and demanded answers. Faced with a hangman's noose, he confessed he'd wanted to prospect in the Blue Mountains with a large enough party to fend off any hostile Native Americans and had made up the whole story as a scheme to recruit one, a party that is. There followed a lively debate over whether or not to kill him. Some of the men he'd recruited had left crops rotting in the ground and land claims unproved up to come with him on this sure-thing adventure, and now they were left completely twisting in the wind, a metaphorical circumstance that they were now eager to replicate for real with a rope and a stout tree and J.L. Adams. In the end, the volunteers decided not to kill him. Instead, they took everything but his clothes, kicked him out of camp, and started for home. On the way, they crossed China Creek. This being a gold prospecting party, they didn't fail to dip their pans in its waters and sling some gravel around. And when they did, they quickly realized they'd hit gold. Lots of it. It wasn't the Blue Bucket Mine, but it was a big enough strike for everyone to stake a lucrative claim, even Adams, who'd been following the party scavenging food from camp leftovers. The little tent camp that grew up around the strike was platted as a town, and they named it Auburn. Now, the town of Blue Bucket has yet to be platted. Is it still out there somewhere on the mountains of northeast Oregon waiting for a weekend adventurer or elk hunter or fly fisherman to stumble across it? Have subsequent floodwaters covered all the yellow pebbles and silt yards deep? Or did some crazy lonely prospector find it and mine it secretly and disappear? Let's face it, we'll never know. The one thing we do know is that generations of Oregonians have shared and appreciated and wondered about this story, around campfires and over dinner tables, for the past 170-odd years. And we know, too, that people looking for it have made history, and would not have done so had it not been for this piece of frontier folklore. As a historical account, it's pretty sketchy. But as a piece of oral folklore, this story's place in state history is assured and well-deserved. Key sources in this story have included works by Ralph Friedman and Keith Clark. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. What you've been listening to is one of more than 700 stories originally created and published as newspaper columns in first-run syndication between 2008 and today. You can read them all at offbeatoregon.com. And other Offbeat Oregon goodies include an active Facebook page, a ton of historic photos, and a bunch more stuff, including visuals for today's show and full citations to sources, all available through our hub page at offbeatoregon.com. We are, by the way, also members of a community of Oregon creators called the Oregon Voices Network, which you can find at oregonvoices.net. It's a hub page that links to Marcus Axford's Welcome to Oregon podcast and the weekly Influential Oregonian podcast that Marcus MCs with me and archaeologist David Winkler, and usually a special guest as well, plus a bunch of other cool stuff, like Discord servers and a Facebook page, so yeah, check it out. It's a cool community, and I'm proud to be part of it. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Questions, critiques, ideas for a future episode? Email me at fj@offbeatoregon.com. Episodes of Offbeat Oregon History are uploaded around 6 a.m. every weekday, so the next one will be on your device and ready to go before you know it. Until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now!